Macklin's Women by J. R. Roberts. Narrated by Barry Campbell. Chapter 1.
I wasn't quite sure where I was. The reason for that was because I was looking at two signposts. The first sign read, Baxterville, Missouri, population 500. The second, older sign, crossed out, read, Macklinville, Missouri, population 510. I was about to enter Baxterville, Missouri, which had until recently been called Macklinville, a name which rang a bell. I sat a moment, searching through my memory, but when nothing came to mind, I put it aside. With a flick of my wrists, I set my team in motion, and me and my rig were on our way into Baxterville, Missouri, population 500. I wondered idly what had happened to the other 10. When I entered the town proper, I asked the first man I saw where the livery stable was. I was anxious to put up my team and rig and make sure that Duke, my big half-Arabian stallion, who was tied to the rear of the wagon, was cared for. After that, I wanted a couple of beers, a bath, a few more beers with some food, and then some female companionship. As I approached the livery, halfway across the town, a blonde girl was closing the doors, apparently shutting down for lunch. "Excuse me," I called out to her. "Yeah?" she answered, turning and, hands on formidable hips, squinting into the noonday sun as she attempted to make out my face. She appeared to be barely 18, but she had the full breasts and proud bearing of a grown woman. Her wheat-colored hair was long and fine, and the same color eyelashes made her appear to have none at all. A cluster of freckles played across the bridge of her nose, which wrinkled up as she continued peering at my face. She had a wide mouth. All that marred her wholesome good looks was the absence of one of her front teeth. It did little, however, to damage her overall appeal. I stepped down from the wagon so as to save her further difficulty with the sun. Once I was on the ground, she was able to take a good, frank look at me. What she saw was a tall, lean man covered with trail dust and a week's worth of stubble. Cleaned up, I might have been called pleasant-looking, but at the moment I looked like hell.
"Can I help you?"
she asked.
"Well, I'd like to put up my rig and have my animals cared for, but I see that you're closing up. For lunch?"
"'S right. Paul's laid up with a broke leg, so I got to close up to eat or I don't eat," she explained.
"I see. Well," I began, scratching my head like I was pondering a major problem. "I can't very well leave my horses and rig standing out here, can I?"
"Not if and you want 'em to be here when you get back."
"Say," I said, hoping I looked like I had just gotten the best idea since the wheel, "I'll tell you what. What's your name?"
"Lizzie."
"I'll tell you what, Lizzie, if you'll put up my rig and care for my horses, I'll buy you the biggest lunch you ever had. How's that sound?" Without hesitation, she said,
"That sounds right nice, mister."
"Clint."
"Clint, are you sure you can afford it?"
she asked, eyeing me doubtfully.
"I'm a right big eater when I'm hungry, and right now I'm powerful hungry," she warned.
"With a figure like yours, I would have thought you hardly ate a thing all day."
"That's nice of you, Clint, but truth be told, I'm kind of a big girl, and it takes a lot of food to keep me going. Pa says he's seen me eat more than some of the horses we put up here."
Talking about her own figure caused her to suck in her tummy some, which caused her impressive breasts to stand out all the more. I had to agree with Lizzie, she certainly was a big girl, and that was just the way I liked 'em.
"I can afford it," I assured her. "What do you say?"
"I'll take care of your animals and then meet you at Hobson's Saloon just down the block. After that, we can go over to the cafe for that big lunch."
"Let me drive the rig inside," I offered.
She opened the doors wide and I guided the team inside, then hopped down and told her, "Take special care of the Duke here." She came over next to me and said,
"He sure is a beautiful animal. Got a plain name for such a fancy-looking horse," she added.
"Duke likes it," I assured her. I'd had Duke for 4 years, since he was a yearling, and by now we were pretty much able to read each other's minds. "He likes it just fine, don't you, boy?" He nuzzled my hand, then showed good taste by nuzzling Lizzie's as she patted his massive neck. I cupped Lizzie's chin and said,
"Don't be long, I'm almost as hungry as you are."
"I'll be right along," she promised. It looked like I had found everything I wanted all in one place. Outside the livery, I noticed that there had also been a sign change there, recently. The sign that was up now was clean and new and declared that I had just left the Baxterville livery. On the way to the saloon, I passed the general store, where two men were taking down a sign that said Macklin's General Store and preparing to put up one that said Smith's General Store. When I reached the saloon, I saw a large sign lying in the street where it had been trampled a few dozen times. It was upside down, but I was able to make out the words Macklin's Saloon. Above the doorway was a new sign which said Hobson's Saloon. Somebody named Macklin must have had quite a run of bad luck. I walked into the saloon, which wasn't exactly overcrowded at that time of day. There were four cowpokes playing poker at one table and a lone drunk at another, sucking on a bottle. I walked up to the bar and ordered a beer.
"Just right in?" the bartender asked.
I told him I had and accepted the beer from his big hand. He was not a tall man, but he had large shoulders and thick, powerful hands. Handy in a bar fight, I figured. I drank half of the beer and set it on the bar, saying, "Ah, that cuts through the dust nicely."
"Finish it up," he told me, "and have another on the house."
"Well, that's right nice of you," I told him, and downed the remainder of the beer. He drew me another.
"We're kind of celebrating this week."
"New owner?" I asked.
"Kind of. I guess you noticed a few changes going on around town."
"Oh, you mean the sign changes. I noticed that even before I got into town."
"Well, we're celebrating getting our town back from Con Macklin," the bartender told me proudly.
"Con Macklin," I repeated, and then the name struck that chord inside my head. "Con Macklin," I said again, this time because it meant something. The memory went back about 10 years, but it was coming into sharp focus. I'd never met Macklin, but I had seen my share of wanted posters with his name on them while I was a lawman in Kansas, Wyoming, and Texas, among other places. He was a gunman, but one of the smarter ones. He stayed alive and out of jail long enough to disappear from sight about 2 years ago. Now I knew where he went. Baxterville, Missouri, to turn it into Macklinville, Missouri. From the looks of things, it had taken the people of the town 2 years to turn it back into Baxterville.
"You heard of him, huh?" the bartender asked.
"I've heard the name," I admitted. "This was his town, huh?"
"Was is the right word, mister. We run him out."
"He must have had some men with him. What happened to them?"
"Gone. Guess you noticed the drop in our population on the sign."
"Decreased by 10. Macklin and his men?"
"Macklin and his men made up 7. There's 3 more in town, but they'll be leaving before the day is out."
He seemed pretty definite about that.
"What made Macklin and his boys pull out?" I asked.
"New sheriff," he said, proudly, which made me wonder if the new sheriff might not be his son. "He ran Macklin out of town, killed him, buried him, and then came back and told Macklin's boys. Damned if they didn't pull right out the next day."
"With nobody to pay them off, why should they stay?" I remarked.
"That's it, mister."
"Sheriff must be quite a guy. Who's the new sheriff?"
"Dade Whitman."
I put my beer down on the bar so I wouldn't spill any of it.
"Dade Whitman is your new sheriff?"
I asked slowly, hoping I had heard wrong.
"You a friend of his?"
he asked me. I decided to be real careful about my answer, because Whitman had obviously become a big man in this town awful fast. I wouldn't exactly say that Dade and I were old friends, but we have worked together once or twice. "Where exactly is Macklin buried?" I asked.
"In the hills somewhere," he answered, as if the exact location was of no concern to him at all. "Sheriff Whitman didn't even mark his grave, 'cause who'd want to visit it? Just what he deserved, too, that's what I say."
"You're probably right." At that point, the swinging saloon doors opened to admit 3 women. I saw them through the mirror behind the bar and then turned to take a better look. One was older than the other two, maybe in her early to mid-30s. She was a tall redhead with her hair piled high atop her head like a crown. She wore a blue dress and it filled out proudly with well-rounded breasts. Her face wasn't the most beautiful I'd ever seen, but it certainly ranked among the top 10. In addition to all that, a sensuous aura surrounded her that made a man lick his lips.
The other girls were not yet 20. One was blonde, with a figure similar to the older woman's. The third was dark-haired, the youngest of the three, with a very pretty face and a slim figure. The two younger girls were wearing pants and boots and men's shirts. The older woman was the one who spoke.
"I'm looking for a man to act as a guide to Mexico," she announced. "I'll pay good wages, half now and the other half when we get there."
The way the three of them looked, I expected every man in the place to volunteer, but no one moved, and one man from the poker table said, "Get the hell out, bitch!" Another man added, "Take your whores with you!" The red-headed woman threw them a hard glance, and I stood up straighter, sensing trouble.
"Look," she tried again, "we want to get out of this town, but we can't make the trip alone. I said I'd pay good wages."
One of the men stood up from the poker table. He was big, over 6 feet, with "hard case" written all over him. He approached the three women and drawled, "Well now, seems to me if you're willing to pay good wages, you might be willing to throw in a little something extra, like maybe this here little blonde lady," he added, grabbing the blonde around the waist.
"Let go,"
she shouted, beating him on the chest with ineffective punches.
"Come on, girlie, I just want to check you out and see if you're for real."
He cupped one of her firm breasts in his big hand.
"Let her go," the older woman demanded.
She punctuated the demand by ramming a spiked heel into the man's instep. He howled and turned the blonde loose, then threw a backhand at the redhead, catching her high on her cheek. It was only because the dark-haired girl steadied her that she didn't fall.
"Get out, you whore, and take your little bitches with you before I kill you," the man spat at her.
I'd had about enough and started to move forward when the bartender grabbed my arm.
"Mister, those are Con Macklin's women, and if you stand up for them, you're going to be a mighty unpopular fella in this town. Take my advice and just let it ride, huh?"
I stayed undecided long enough for the situation to resolve itself. The woman turned and walked out of the saloon, rubbing her cheek, and the two young girls followed. I caught the eye of the blonde just before she left, and our gazes held a few seconds before she tilted her chin and marched out.
"Have another beer, mister," the bartender told me.
I watched the big man limp back to his seat, where his friends laughed and patted him on the back. Then I turned and accepted the beer. "Can't stand to see women mistreated, especially pretty ones," I told him.
"They're pretty all right, no denying that, but they were Macklin's women, mister. Ain't nobody gonna take her up on her offer, not even if it meant finding Macklin's treasure."
"His treasure?"
"Sure, everybody always wondered what Macklin did with his money. They figured he'd socked it away somewhere, and people started calling it Macklin's buried treasure. Now that he's dead, that redhead might be the only one who knows where it's hid."
He leaned on the bar and lowered his voice.
"Now ain't nobody gonna guide her on the road to Mexico, but there might be some who'd be waiting for her, if you get my meaning."
I did, and told him so without any satisfaction.
"Them gals won't last 2 hours once they leave town," the bartender added, "and all I gotta say is good riddance. Once they're gone, this town will be shuck of any reminder that Con Macklin was ever in this town."
I threw some money on the bar, enough for the beers and a little extra, and said, "Thanks for the drinks, pal, and the advice. Where can I get a bath and a shave?"
"Go out, make a left. When you get to the hardware store, make another left, you'll see it. Big sign outside says baths for 10 cents. When Macklin was here, they was 2 bits and he was taking a cut, but that's all changed now."
"Thanks to Dade Whitman," I added.
"That's right."
"Sure it is," I thought, until Dade Whitman decided to assert himself a little. "I'm meeting a lady here by the name of Lizzie," I told him. "Would you tell her where I went?"
"Sure." He made eyes at me and said, "That Lizzie, if she cottons to you enough to meet you as soon as you hit town, you're in for some night, yes, sir."
"Yeah, thanks." When I left the saloon, the men at the poker table were still ribbing their friend about his sore foot. I took another look at him, although there was no danger that I'd ever forget what he looked like. Any man who would treat a woman the way he did left an impression on my mind, the kind that never faded.
Chapter 2.
After a bath and a shave, I was ready for that big lunch I had promised Lizzie. Approaching the saloon, I grew aware of some commotion inside. It sounded like one or more of the Macklin women had returned and was being given a hard time. When I entered, I saw I was half right. It wasn't a Macklin who was being given a hard time, but it was a woman. It was Lizzie, and she was being manhandled by the same guy who had struck the red-headed Macklin woman. "Come on, Lizzie, you and me, we could have some fun together," he was telling her. He was holding her by the arm, and from the way she was wincing, I could tell it hurt. "Let her go," I said aloud. The big man switched his gaze from Lizzie to me and said, "What did you say?" The big man's friends also looked from Lizzie to me with open curiosity. The bartender put a hand over his eyes and shook his head, but I could only see one hand. His other was beneath the bar. "You heard me, friend," I told the big man. "You may be stupid, but I don't think you're deaf," I told him. One of the other men gave a crooked laugh and asked me, "Do you know who you're talking to, pard?" "No, as a matter of fact, I don't. All I see is a big man with a big mouth who likes to pick on women." I directed myself at the man we were talking about and said, "Now, let go of her arm. The lady and I have a date for lunch."
"Lady?" he laughed. "Did you say lady? Pal, this ain't no lady, and I just broke your date, so why don't you..."
"Maybe I was wrong, friend," I told him. "Maybe you are deaf as well as stupid. Let the girl go. Watch my lips move. Let her go." The man's face hardened, and he released Lizzie's arm and shoved her aside. He turned his body so that he was facing me and let his right hand hang by his gun.
"Mister, you're looking for a fast trip to your grave, and I'm the man who can give it to you."
His friends moved out of the line of fire in a hurry, so I didn't think I was going to have to deal with them. "Listen, friend," I said, "I don't like to kill a man without knowing his name. I consider it bad luck, you know, so what's your name?" I sensed some movement behind him and started to realize that maybe I was wrong about his friends. By now the room was so quiet that we all heard the sound of the hammer of a revolver as it was being cocked. If I wasn't mistaken, it had come from beneath the bar where the bartender's right hand was. "You and me, friend," I told the big man, figuring that the bartender had the rest of them covered. "What's your name?" I asked him again.
"Shagan."
"Okay, Shagan, apologize to the lady and nobody has to get hurt. It's as simple as that." The tension in the air was like something solid. I kept my eyes on Shagan's, waiting for him to make a move. His eyes would tell me what that move would be. When one of his hands finally moved, it went to the buckle of his gun belt, undid it, and let it drop to the floor.
"I don't need my gun to take care of you," he said.
There wasn't much difference in our height, but he outweighed me by a good 30 pounds or so. He had more confidence in his ability to beat me to a pulp than he did in his ability to beat me to the draw. I let my gun belt drop to the floor and waited for him to move. He was predictable. Most men that size will try and use their weight against you. In his case, he ran toward me, meaning to throw himself on me and topple me to the floor. I decided not to take any chances with him. I picked up a chair and hit him over the head with it. He fell to the floor, bleeding from a gash on his forehead, just barely conscious. "You better help him up and take him out," I told his friends, bending to retrieve my gun belt and buckle it on. I walked over to Lizzie and asked, "Are you all right?" From behind me, I could hear them dragging him to his feet and helping him outside. "I'm fine," she told me. "Thanks." "I'm hungry," I told her. I didn't want anything to delay that lunch we had planned. I turned to the bartender and said, "What's your name?"
"Sam Hobson."
"Mr. Hobson, I want to thank you for backing me up."
"My pleasure," he told me, "but it would have been kind of hard to do if they had called my bluff."
"How's that?" He reached under the bar and put an old Navy Colt on top of it.
"This piece is busted. It can't fire. I use it as a club. About the only thing I can do with it is cock the hammer."
"Well, Sam," I told him, "that was enough, wasn't it?"